Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now to discuss the recent Arctic Council meeting in Reykjavik when Iceland was turning over chairmanship of the body to Russia are Heather Connolly of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where she is the Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and the Arctic, and Michael Kaufman, the Director of Russia Studies at the Center for Naval Analyses. Guys, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Vago.
Yeah, thanks for having us on your podcast.
Absolute pleasure having you guys both on. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems is sponsoring our air and missile defense coverage. Heather, start us off, right? Interesting meeting as Iceland wrapped up its two-year chairmanship of the Arctic Council, something I think a little bit more conventional. Russia now taking it over. First opportunity for Secretary of State Tony Blinken to meet in person in his new job with Sergei Lavrov, the long-serving Russian foreign minister, who set a more muscular tone for what we should expect over the coming 2 years. Talk to us about sort of the major takeaways from this meeting.
For me, the first takeaway is that Secretary of State Tony Blinken spent nearly 4 days in the Arctic region in the middle of an extraordinary conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. He spent 4 days trying to return America diplomatically, certainly, to the Arctic, reinforcing the U.S. return to a multilateral approach to climate change. Exactly as you mentioned, I think really the substantive work of the visit was the bilateral with Sergei Lavrov, which was the a stepping stone to what came several days later as the announcement that Putin and President Biden will meet in Geneva on June the 16th. But it was a way of restoring U.S. leadership back to the Arctic, and it was very welcome. The good news here is that Russia has always been cooperative in the Arctic Council for a variety of reasons. They want to keep this channel open, and the other Arctic states, in fact, want to keep that channel open and keep the Arctic in a cooperative framework. But you are right, Minister Lavrov was very clear that the geopolitics of the region, something that the Arctic Council does not deal with. It is prohibited in the Ottawa Declaration to address anything that has a meaningful impact on hard security. There are search and rescue, oil spill response, that kind of, we could say, softer security, although any type of security in the Arctic is just hard to do. But, this is an attempt, quite frankly, to be one of the key positive elements on the U.S.-Russian bilateral agenda, climate, of course, but the Arctic. So I think that was in large part the measure, strong message of U.S. returning to the Arctic, spending important time and getting the U.S.-Russian relationship in a good place on climate and the Arctic.
I should also point out, right, that Tony Blinken told Copenhagen that the United States definitively is not in Greenland, which was something serious, obviously, for former President Trump, or not so serious, depending on who you talk to. Michael, how did you see the meeting and some of the messages the Russian side certainly was delivering? Because it seemed to be in the line of sort of Russian pragmatism. Hey, let's talk about what's on the table at a time when Russia is really stepping up its infrastructure and militarization game across the region.
One of the Russian goals in the Arctic Council in terms of the chairmanship is to actually not discuss the subject of Russian military modernization, investment, or force structure expansion in the Arctic. The Russian position typically is, look, this is Russian military hardware. It's all taking place on Russian territory. This part of the Arctic is quote unquote Russia's because, a lot of the Russian thinking on the subject is less oriented towards governance and much more oriented towards sovereignty and the idea of sovereigntism, right? And there, possession is, in geopolitics can be 100% the law. So The Russian approach is let's focus the Arctic Council discussion on other issues, you know, social economic growth, environmental protection, strengthening the Arctic Council. But they also would like to engage in a security-oriented conversations, if possible, with military leaders. This could be something along the lines of maybe restoring the Arctic Chief of Defense meeting that used to exist but was suspended after Russian seizure and annexation of Crimea. As you know, Russian military modernization investment in terms of its footprint, both in the Western Arctic and also in the Eastern Arctic, continues apace. And I'm not seeing any let up in that department. I think the Arctic is part of a general conversation on strategic stability that Russia would like to have with the United States and on de-escalation. Part of the reason for that is the Arctic is actually in the area where strategic nuclear weapons are deployed or operate, whether it's Russian ballistic missile submarines coming out of the Northern Fleet in one of their central patrol areas not far from the Kola Peninsula, or it's, you know, strategic bomber overflights or U.S. strategic bomber exercises which frequent the Arctic. So there's ways of wrapping that conversation into broader strategic stability talks between the United States and Russia. And we know the administration is both interested in this agenda and interested to explore ways to de-escalate, although the substance of that agenda is not yet clear or fleshed out. That's one of the things that Blinken was doing with Lavrov for the upcoming summit that's taking place, I think, June 16th between Putin and Biden.
How do we, though, right? I mean, this sort of duality, on the one hand, Norwegians will point out we have a great working relationship with the Russians on a functional level, whereas in private, they'll be like, look, the Russians are provoking and doing a whole bunch of things that are concerning. Swedes have been ringing the alarm for some time. And in fact, you know, the Russians have been behaving more muscular in a more muscular fashion, whether it's in the Baltic or elsewhere in the region. How much longer can this sort of go on this parallel path? Because the Russians have a tendency of tying, right? We always want to separate these channels, whereas for the Russians, it's one contiguous field in which you use all of these different knobs of influence, power, coercion, disinformation, right? That are not necessarily as separable as we would like. What's the next phase of this? And what are some of the issues that President Biden, Putin are going to have to address? Because, you know, this was going on. I mean, we'll get to the Belarus hijacking, if you want to call it anything else, of the Ryanair flight was playing out just, you know, in the aftermath of this meeting and before, you know, Biden and Putin are going to meet. Heather, why don't you start us off, and then Michael, I want to get your sense on this.
We don't yet know the Biden administration's policy towards the Arctic. Secretary Blinken's visit gave us some insights, but in some ways it was about differentiating the Biden administration from the Trump administration, clearly on climate change, as you mentioned, trying to continue to wind back the, you know, we want to purchase Greenland comment from former President Trump. But they haven't yet fully articulated what the response is. Return to climate. Absolutely, clearly. But on the geopolitics, what will it be? Will it be a continuation of the U.S. military doing freedom of navigation operations in the Barents Sea, you know, rotating, you know, 700 Marines to Norway, you know, a U.S. nuclear submarine, temporarily based in a Norwegian facility that had never even happened during the Cold War. So we are, we are coming back and restoring ourselves strategically to the Arctic in a much smaller way than we did in the Cold War. But we don't know how that policy will fully manifest itself. So I think number one, the Biden administration, it'd be great for them to clarify their entire Arctic policy. But to Michael's point, it's really important for us to understand what Russia is doing in the Arctic and why. I mean, Mike was very clear, you know, there is the Russian, the Eastern Arctic That military buildup is primarily just to make sure they can see what's coming into their territory through the Northern Sea Route. So that's right. Just radar and things like that. The Western Arctic, the buildup on the Kola Peninsula, the fact that, you know, there are, you know, pretty substantial military capabilities being placed on Franz Josef Land, which is the most northerly part of the Russian archipelago, that has concerns for North American security for sure. Missile development, new equipment, the exercising tempo. So I actually, you know, I agree with Minister Lavrov. I don't often say that. We do need a forum to talk about this so we don't misunderstand one another. We don't have an accident, that we understand what we're doing. I think that's going to be important, a part ensuring that the Arctic remains a stable cooperative place.
And I want to, before we go to Michael, I thought that the video that came out, I want to say it was probably about 4 years ago, where the narrator is saying, you know, it was talking about some airborne regiment. Michael, you probably remember this video, and Heather, I'm sure you remember it as well. And there are arrows going to project force in Russia's sphere of influence, and it goes to Franz Josef Land, Jan Mayer, and then goes to Svalbard as well. And I'm like, wait a minute. And so Norwegian friends of mine had watched the video and they were like, wait a minute, that's not yours. Anyway,
and
go ahead, Michael.
No, I mean, it's great. Mike's going to be so much more knowledgeable of this, but this is what we don't understand. We don't understand why there would be such a significant military buildup in Franz Josef Land. For what purpose? That has nothing to do with, you know, sort of making sure search and rescue centers and that you are protecting your territorial waters. That has something else. And that's what we don't understand. Sorry, Mike, over to you.
When we look at Russian military investments, first of all, we have to appreciate that. While we can't characterize them necessarily being defensive or offensive, a number of them are based around strong Russian concerns that there is the threat in the initial period of war of a mass U.S. airspace attack across the Arctic. And there's a need to basically, from their point of view, establish a picket line, a sort of screen of radar facilities, air defense facilities, and air bases with tactical aviation to both have visibility, but also to push that airspace attack further out or to be able to engage it. Similarly, it's an opening theater, and that's one of their biggest fears, because they're so behind in terms of infrastructure investment there that U.S. naval forces could begin to operate there over time, could deploy surface action groups, carrier strike groups with long-range land attack cruise missiles, potentially with missile defense systems and the like. This is probably the fears that drive a lot of Russian investments. But another aspect of it is, of course, they see the Arctic as a strategic resource base. They think that's where Russia's future is. Russia is in many ways an economy based on resource extraction and export, and they see tremendous reserves there and expect there to be competition for them, and they don't really intend to engage in much competition. They intend to say that this is ours, and anybody else who wants to operate in this area has to ask Russian permission. In fact, that's one of the arguments over the Northern Sea Route, which they see as a national sea line of communication. They want folks to not only ask permission, but even take Russian pilots aboard to transit it in cases. You know, the important thing for me is when we look at the Arctic, as Heather said, we can separate the Eastern Arctic, because they're actually, the United States and Russia have a very well-run border. It's probably one of the greatest borders in terms of a border between great powers and its demarcation, stability, and the like. And the situation in the Western Arctic is quite different. What we're witnessing right now is kind of the securitization of this environment's conversation. And the irony is that everybody's talking about it. They can see the problem. They're admiring it. And they all say, well, the Arctic's one of the last areas of cooperation to some extent. And we really need cooperation here because of climate change and the threat it imposes. But on the other hand, everybody's actually engaging in a lot of activities to further drive securitization and to some extent exacerbate what looks like an emerging security dilemma there. You know, Norway, for example, I don't think has a very balanced policy. They're clearly drawing U.S. presence, offering the United States various types of military basing. And this is without doubt is going to draw a reaction from Russia. Russians are very clear about it. So other countries like Finland are much more balanced in their approach. Norway may have concerns regarding Svalbard and some of the disputes they have, particularly economic access disputes they have with Russia there. I don't know how much U.S. presence is really going to help in that kind of scenario contingency. But nonetheless, it's very clear the direction Norwegian foreign policy has taken. My main concern is that it's pretty clear where this can go. The environment in the Arctic right now is not militarized, but as military activity is taking place there, but it's not the most defining feature aspect of it. But it can be. And we should be honest that the way countries are running policies right now, Russia probably at the forefront of that, but other European countries are also engaging in politics that to my view exacerbate this. It can end up being a bed of nails, and then everybody's going to have to lie in it.
Heather, what are some of your anticipations of how this summit meeting is going to go, and what you think the issues the administration has to have on the table when it meets with Putin, right? Because there's a lot to discuss, right? That goes well beyond Arctic and climate. It goes to the SolarWinds attack, fundamental disagreements, Middle East, pretty much anywhere in the world you go, there's likely more friction than less. And now you have Russia being the only country that's lauding the Lukashenko's decision to send a MiG to intercept a Ryanair flight to pull a pro-democracy activist off the plane as he was heading from Athens to Vilnius. What are the issues that have to be on the list?
What the Biden administration wants from the U.S.-Russia summit, and they would refute this term and this term, but they want a soft reset. In some ways, again, the words are to create a stable and predictable relationship. The problem is the Kremlin bases its foreign policy on unpredictability and instability, which helps create opportunities for it. So while I applaud the goal, I'm a little suspect that we're going to be able to get there. But the reason I call it a soft reset is that if you look at the parallels between the 2009 reset, which then Vice President Biden announced, it's the same goals. Arms control, strategic stability, you know, this is using the next 5 years very well to create new arms control architecture, because we've pulled all the architecture down around it other than New START. Iran, getting the Russians to agree on a new Iran nuclear agreement. Afghanistan, maybe added to that. That's exactly what it was in 2009 with the Northern Distribution Network. The new element is the Arctic and climate change. Can that be a positive agenda? And so trying to get those strategic objectives. But at the same time, the Biden administration is going to be much more forceful in contesting Russian behavior, particularly in neighboring countries, Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova, Syria, the Eastern Mediterranean. That's an area of conversation. And so the thing is, can we do both? Can we contest and cooperate at the same time? Can we sanction for poor behavior, but still keep those avenues of cooperation open? This has been the dilemma for U.S. policy towards Russia for 30 years. We have a little burst of enthusiasm for the first couple of months, and then we roll back to the reality that it's more contestation than cooperation.
Michael?
If we're going with characterizations that the administration is not going to like and probably will refute, I'd probably call it detente light from my point of view. Not perhaps not too dissimilar from what Heather used to describe it. I think that first, the problem is that the agenda is incredibly shallow relative to some of its aims. And the conversation on strategic stability and de-escalation in terms of substance really risks being completely taken over by just arms control negotiations regarding New START or other agreements. And there's absolutely no guarantee of success even there. In fact, that limited agenda is pretty fraught with potential pitfalls. And the only seeming desire end state for the administration is to kind of stabilize the contest and then hope that something happens in Russia or in terms of Russian foreign policy consensus that'll make it easier to deal with down the line. But let's get serious. We're probably going to end up making foreign policy by crisis. And big parts of this approach are not likely to survive whatever next crises come down the line, whether it's Belarus or something else, given what history has taught us in recent years. And the truth is that, at least from my point of view, this administration has, like many other administrations that came up before it, with the exception of the first Obama administration, has just not sufficiently prioritized Russia, right? They really want to be dealing with China. Russia is not just a second in terms of priority, but it's a very distant second. And like other administrations, as soon as they got in, they found out that Russia actually gets a very big vote on where it's going to be in terms of U.S. foreign policy priorities, especially if they feel that they've been deprioritized on the agenda. So they're going to put themselves on there, and they're going to put themselves on there consistently much higher the administration would like to see. And that's likely the way things are going to go. So this is my general sense of it. I do see important differences between this administration and others, but I don't think they're nearly that tremendous.
I would say, you know, the interesting strategic hubris of this is, you know, just like some in the last administration was saying, you know, we're going to break China, or every once in a while people will say, well, we're going to break Russia, not understanding it's really the largest country in Europe, you know, and we haven't broken the North Koreans yet. So with the abundance of resources and the parallel economic infrastructure that Russia has created for itself, you know, it was interesting. I think, Heather, you and I were at the Halifax summit where a cyber expert was talking about how the Russians were dramatically improving their own cyber game because of sanctions, right? That gave them an opportunity to create their own IT infrastructure to take it away from, you know, something that can be penalized by the West and Europeans in the wake of Ukraine. I want to take you guys to the question of Belarus and this extraordinary incident, which I'm not sure there's already parallel that I recall, at least in recent memory, of a nation state deploying a fighter to intercept a commercial airline flight in order to grab somebody off the plane. What do you make of the incident, Heather? And how does the international community have to respond to it? And what tools are there, or do countries, whether it's Lukashenko or Putin, simply not care anymore, and that's actually the bigger message?
Thinking about what Mike just said, the quote that comes to my mind, Trotsky, forgive me, you may not be interested in Russia, but Russia is very interested in you. And that's, I think, exactly what we're going to see. So Belarus, I think the broader message, whether this comes from Minsk or from Moscow, is that no one is safe. These regimes can get anyone, whether it's the Skripals in Salisbury, assassinating Chechen dissidents in the streets of Berlin, or, you know, forcing a civilian airliner down. You are not safe. And it also shows, you know, what is the West going to do about this? So that's the broader message to opposition and anyone that they believe crosses them. And, you know, I think it's a very strong message. This act in some ways is the final break. Lukashenko for 27 years has done the two-step. When he gets pressure from Moscow to do things he doesn't want to do, he curries favor with the West. When the West starts demanding that Lukashenko does things and pressure him to do things he doesn't want to do, then he swings to Moscow. That two-step is done. He's got one step, and he now is completely beholden to the Kremlin for his sustainability in his regime, his own survival politically. And that's fairly dangerous because what Lukashenko is going to have to agree to, I think, over time with increase of Russian forces being permanently based in Belarus, he will have no choice. He will just be engulfed and incorporated. And so it's interesting, as we were watching over the last year after the August 9th failed presidential election, you know, previously it was the Russians that were admiring Lukashenko's tactics against the opposition and actually incorporating them into their playbook of suppression and repression. And now I think we've seen sort of another very bold example of very aggressive repression tactics. But this one, like many Russian activities, this one blew up in their face. And the fact that the European Union was able to so quickly and decisively, not two words that I put often in a sentence about the EU formulating foreign policy, it's pretty decisive. If they go after the sectoral implications, the Belarusian potash energy, this could be very devastating, and it will require now Russia in many ways to continue to pay for Belarus and its hemorrhaging economy. And that's not something that I think the Kremlin really wants to pay for. So we are really in a new place. This was a real break from, you know, the last 27 years. I just don't know where it's going to go from here.
But Lukashenko does owe Putin, right? Because you're absolutely right that there, Moscow was looking at him. But frankly, Lukashenko is in power because of a lot of Russian help on an intelligence, on tactics, and all manner of brutality. And it is interesting, Russians, you know, in a time when the United States is abandoning Afghanistan, I think it's very, very interesting the message Russia is sending pretty much every authoritarian government in the world is, hey, if we've got a deal, if I've got your back, you can count on me on having your back. I don't cut and run, whether it's Syria or, Belarus or anywhere else, which I think is sadly a powerful message that does resonate around the world. Michael, what's your sense in terms of the hijack incident or what it means broadly, and whether you agree with Heather that the EU is on the right track, right? I mean, how do you punish something like this to make sure that it never happens again?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know if you can ensure that it never happens again. It's not the first time it's happened in Europe. You can probably try to ensure that Belarus doesn't do it again. And this is one of those cases where it's hard to see EU have something in the way of a foreign policy, but certainly the EU can organize itself when it comes to being reactionary to this kind of gross violation of norms. I'd like to pick up on a thread of what you were just saying about Lukashenko. Putin has Lukashenko's back, but I have to be honest that this is actually a problem for Russia as well. Moscow's whole scheme is to try to orchestrate a transition of power in Belarus that eventually shows the door to Lukashenko and replaces him with people in the sustained regime that nonetheless is friendly towards Russia and oriented towards Moscow. Putin privately and personally despises Lukashenko. Everybody knows this. There's no love lost between these two dictators. And to be honest, when Lukashenko probably thinks of Putin having his back, he's probably picturing a very large blade entering his back over the coming year. So he understands that maybe if in this case Russia is backing him, it is only to buy time in order to actually get him out of Belarus and to install a kind of more stable and sustainable regime that nonetheless does not pursue a Western orientation or a geopolitically more pro-Western foreign policy.
I want to end this by bringing you guys in the brief time we've got left. We've only got about 2 minutes left to the beginning of the conversation about the Arctic Council. In their book, 2034, Elliot Ackerman and Jim Stavridis write about, you know, pretty much collusion between Russia and China that I think has focused people's attention that these two countries, even if they have tensions between themselves, it's not the Cold War where, you know, Stalin and Mao trust each other, that they are increasingly in cahoots. How is that closer Sino-Russian cooperation going to manifest itself in the Arctic?
Are seeing greater Sino-Russian cooperation across several fields, clearly economic. This is in part because of Western sanctions. Russia is very late in reorienting its energy markets towards Asian markets. And the crown jewel in the Russian Arctic is the Yamal LNG project. And that has Chinese as well as Japanese and other investment. China's quite interested in those energy resources. They're quite interested in some of the mineral resources, some of the infrastructure, this sort of the Polar Silk Road or the Ice Silk Road. So there is economic interest. The Russians need China to invest more in the Russian Arctic than the Chinese are actually interested in investing, but there's that. There is military. The last three annual military exercises that the Russians have hosted, beginning with Vostok or their Eastern Military District, annual exercise in 2018, incorporated the Chinese military the last two, three, whether that was the center exercises in 2019, Kavkaz. So the Chinese, both naval as well as land forces and air in the Indo-Pacific, they are exercising more. There's also scientific cooperation. They just announced last year a Sino-Russian scientific center in the Arctic. So you do have a widening relationship. The Chinese give great deference to the Russians. That drive for respect is very great. But let's make no mistake about it. In this relationship, Russia is the junior partner, is becoming more of a junior partner. But it's an opportunity for Russia to stay at that great power table and be in that anti-Western coalition. So this is something to watch. China's presence in the Arctic and Mike's group has done doing some fantastic work in the space. It's not that significant, economic and scientific, but they have a very long strategic vision that we don't completely appreciate. So something important to watch, certainly in all spheres, economic, military, as well as science.
Michael?
I think that we are seeing a degree of partnership or entente between Russia and China that's only growing, particularly in military technical cooperation sphere, and to a degree in terms of economic cooperation. I think that the nature of the partnership still was worth looking at on a case-by-case basis. As we know, it's true, China has a much more diverse, complex economy that's larger. But in when interactions between great powers, a power cannot simply go to another one and say, hey, I have a much larger GDP than you, I should just get my way on things. And one place where you're definitely going to see a strong asymmetry in Russia's favor is in the Arctic, because Russia is an Arctic power, has over 40% of the Arctic, and China is not. But China is heavily invested in resource extraction, mineral mining across the Arctic in different European countries. And also, as Heather said, investing in energy extraction in Russia. So there, Russia holds tremendous advantages. If China wants to operate in the Arctic, if it wants to conduct economic activity there and the like, it will ultimately depend on Russia to some extent. So perhaps that's one area in the relationship where Russia still holds very distinct advantages over China, but very much a picture worth watching. I think that, as always, from the U.S. perspective, the most important thing about this relationship is that Russia and China are pursuing their respective contests with the United States separately, but together, right? They are taking up risk with vis-a-vis each other, and they are focusing in their respective contests and fights against in contests with the United States without draining resources to focus on each other so much. And that's really an important dynamic that's going to play itself out for the foreseeable future.
And before we go, Heather, in like 10 seconds, it's one thing for the EU to say admirably, right, we will punish you and this is how we'll punish you. The question is, Hungary, for example, is always a stick in the mud and figures out some way to, you know, come to Vladimir Putin's aid as this sort of domestic cavalry. How does this play out ultimately?
Yeah, I mean, the devil's going to be in the details. If the EU goes big and they're really going after sectoral, this is not pinprick sanctions on individuals, because individuals in Belarus, they don't care if they're not going to travel, but really big economic implications, this will hit EU countries. So we may have a little bit of a weakening. We saw just the NATO statement on Belarus was weakened reportedly because Turkey wanted to weaken it. So this is the politics. You've got to get everybody on board. But let's hope the EU stays strong, goes big, and makes an impact here. This event demands a strong response.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. It's really a pleasure having you guys on, and look forward to having you guys back on again before and after the summit. Lot to discuss. Thanks so very much, and hope you guys have a great holiday weekend.
You too. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Larry. Take care.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.